his go-to saying is, get into service.
Hi, my name is Mike, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 29th, 1997. Thank you. If I get emotional, I'm tired right now. I have a sponsee that's been in ICU for 3 weeks, and I'm just dealing with that, and we'll get to that later. I thank Bill for asking me to speak. I come here because this is one of the things I do to keep me sober. You don't say no to an AA request. My hope is that when I come here tonight, that God will say something to you through me, and that I'll hear something or see something in you guys that God wants me to see. It's been my experience at every single meeting that I've ever gone to that if I'm open to that, which is 99% of them, I'll see or hear something that God wants me to see. And for that, I'm blessed. I'll do my introduction, which we call the Drunkalogue. I'm going to talk about the steps. I'm going to talk about sponsorship. I'm going to talk about service. My story goes like this. I was born in Fresno, 1957. I started drinking at the age of 12, so that was the summer of 1969. Later that summer, I smoked pot. And I'll touch on drugs during this because I did a lot of them, and I'm not going to go into it, but I am going to touch on them. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous, in keeping with the traditions. I'm going to keep the recovery to alcohol. You know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. AA is what I've based everything on, and it's where I have found my recovery. I didn't start here, but this is where I'm going to stay. So I started drinking at 12. The first time I drank, it was hard liquor because I wanted to feel what the effect was because I didn't know. And I liked it. I liked the way it made me feel. From the first drink on, I never drank other than for the effect. You know, I learned to like different things that I drank. And finished with whiskey and came to really enjoy the straight whiskey taste. But I drank and I smoked pot, and I did that when I could get away with it as often as I could at a young age. I had to sneak around and hide that, as most kids do. My parents were both present, so I had to work at sneaking that stuff around. I discovered hard drugs at about 16. I found speed, and I took to that like a duck to water, and it wound up being my drug of choice. I went on to try everything else. By the time I was about 17, I wanted to be a biker. I bought my first Harley. I was too young to be a member in a club because of my age, but through business associations and friendships, I was taken under the wing of a 1% club called the Norsemen. And they ran with the Hells Angels. And I was going to be a biker because it was fun and, you know, I wanted to be a tough guy. I ran with those guys. I met a girl in high school, married her. It was my high school sweetheart. By the time we got married, we were 20. I was off into all sorts of drugs. I had a full-time job. She had a full-time job. She worked for the phone company. I worked for Safeway. I got loaded every day. I drank every day. I was very functional. I was able to hide it very well. I was clean-cut looking. My job required me to have a haircut similar to what I have now. And I was able to fit in socially. And I did what most people learn to do, and that's to be a chameleon and fit in where you are. You know, I came here tonight dressed like this out of respect for the membership and the program. I'm as equally comfortable in a pair of Doc Martens and a pair of jeans on one of my Harleys. So I got married, didn't go to college. My wife graduated valedictorian from school with me. She didn't go to college. We both had full-time jobs. Again, me with Safeway, her with the phone company. Bought a house at 20, had a couple cars, a motorcycle, a house, and a boat at 20 years old. We had good money. I sold drugs. We had it going on. And I was content to work and play and wound up doing a lot more playing than working. That went on for a while. We did not want to have children because we just wanted to play. And everything continued the same for about probably 5 years of my marriage. I got to that point where I didn't feel tough enough. I was still running with the bikers, but what started happening was I wound up in some gnarly fights, some stabbings, a couple shootouts, and these weren't like Western shootouts where a lot of people got shot. This is where somebody cracked off a couple rounds in a parking lot and maybe a restaurant, but there were a lot of people and everybody ran like hell. And I found that stuff exciting. In retrospect, it was the stuff I did because I was afraid and I wanted to be tough. And when I could walk around with these guys and the people parted, I felt like I was safe. And that was, in retrospect, why I did what I did. I started, probably as 25, 27, I started using steroids because I wasn't big and bad enough. So I was going to get healthy, so I quit drinking and I quit doing all the street drugs, and I just went to steroids for a couple of years, put on some size, got real strong, was able to walk around in a t-shirt and people could see me and say, you know, they knew I worked out. And, you know, I was all proud of that. I'm still riding motorcycles. I'm still dealing drugs. What came after the steroids was the ego got a hold of me, and my wife wasn't good enough. And she was a wonderful woman. And I started cheating on my wife. By then, I was stealing from my employer, lying to people, cheating on my wife. I had already learned how to live this double life and hide it from my parents. I just took it a step further. It was all about me. And in retrospect, what I found was that I wasn't content being a normal person. I needed all this stuff, and I used it to feel alive. So what the alcohol, the drugs, and the behavior gave me was a thrill. And I was able to basically have thrills on demand by taking a drink, taking a drug, or doing some crazy behavior. I got lucky a lot of times on a lot of things. By the time I was 21, I'd been arrested numerous felonies as a juvenile. As an adult, I was arrested for felony theft, felony drug possession, and felony assault. My parents were friends with people that were pretty high up in the police department. And one particular example, when I got arrested for assault, I got booked into the jail because they didn't find out about me soon enough. So I went to jail, spent the night there. The OR man came to see me, which surprised me because I didn't think he would visit me. He did. I signed the stuff. I got rolled up, walked out of the front door later that morning. When I walked through the exit, there was a police detective there that was a friend of my parents. And I said, you know, what are you doing here, Bill? And he goes, your mom called me. That OR form you signed, you won't be getting a court notice. Shut up and get in the car. And that's as far as a felony assault case went. What I found was by getting away with all of that stuff, it just allowed me to keep doing it. There were no consequences for my action. I felt no pain. I caused a lot of pain, but I felt no pain. So therefore, I didn't have a problem. And I just continued. Things went on like that. I continued my ways, cheating on my wife, doing what I did. And one day my wife came home and said, they're going to lay us off. They're laying a bunch of people. They're splitting the company. I'm going to lose my job. She got laid off. We took her pension money and partied it away. I was working at Safeway. Not too long after that, they started closing stores, and I knew I was going to be out of a job. So now we had habits, we had bills, we had a lifestyle to maintain, and I needed money. But I wanted a job. So there was a job available working for the Fresno County Sheriff's Department. And I was strung out on meth, had a long criminal history that nobody knew about, and decided that this would be a good job for me. So I went to my doctor and said, hey, I think I got a drug problem. And I told him, and about two sentences into it, he goes, I've heard enough. He gave me a referral to this place called the Ark. I went there. I had good insurance. They did the intake thing. They asked me all the questions. They got to the one about what drugs did you do, and I did every single drug on that page except for heroin. And then I rattled off a few more that weren't on the page. She goes, come on in. And I said, okay, but give me a minute to think about it. And I ran out. I wasn't willing to give up control. I wasn't willing to let somebody help me. I needed to get from point A to point B, and I was going to do it on my terms. So my next step was, I'll try Narcotics Anonymous. And this is where my recovery started. So August 31st, 89, I quit doing drugs. It was my belly button birthday. I quit doing drugs. I had this job that I wound up taking 3 months later, and I had to look good for it. So I went to Narcotics Anonymous, and they had a book, and they had steps, and they had a program and sponsorship and all the meetings and that you guys know. And I looked at the steps and said, okay, and I saw one thing in there that said, don't substitute one drug for another, and I ignored it because it wasn't convenient. I went to meetings, I quit doing drugs, I did not get a sponsor, I did not work the steps, I did not affiliate or associate with anybody in the program, and I went on whiskey therapy. So, because I wasn't an alcoholic, I just liked to drink. I was a drug addict, and I had a drug problem, but I didn't have any other problems, and if I got rid of that one, then I had it going on. So I went to those meetings, got the job, and quit going there. So I took a job with the sheriff's department. I was the same old me, new job, fresh start. Knew all my mistakes, knew what I did wrong. I was the guy that people were tired of working with. Employers were shifting to other job sites because they didn't like the way I behaved. They didn't like my attendance record. They didn't like my poor attitude. They didn't know I was stealing like crazy from them. I took this job with the sheriff's department, did all this stuff, still had the same behaviors. My wife wasn't good enough, and what it was the thrill factor had worn off. I needed to push the boundaries a little further, because everything's progressive, and it wasn't enough. So I'm at work, and I met the wild alcoholic woman that understood me. And she could rappel down buildings and shoot machine guns, and we went out drinking and carousing together, and we had a good time. So I left my wife. I had a baby. She was about 5-6 years old, and I just came home one day, and this thing had been going on with my girlfriend for a number of months, and I said, you know what, I can't be here anymore. No warning, no nothing. I just packed up, and I said, I gotta go. And but I took good care of them. I left them set up, new car, nice house, lots of money. I did all that stuff, so therefore, I took care of them, and I made it right. So I took up with this gal, and we drank and did the stuff we did, fought like hell, couldn't get along, your typical alcoholic relationship. And I'll be damned if she didn't go enter an outpatient program for AA. And that gal could outdrink me. And so she did this outpatient program. I went there with her to check it out, and they told me that I was a candidate for AA. And I said, I don't think so. And I remember talking to this guy, Barry, that had the program. He goes, what do you drink? And I said, well, I like Kessler. I can get whatever I want, but that's what I like. And he goes, oh, I used to drink that, and I switched to Jack Daniels because the bottle kept rolling under the bed at night, and I couldn't find it. And, I didn't get that. And so I said, you know what, I'm okay. I'll just kind of ride along the side here and support her. So went to meetings, AA. So I went to meetings. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. I didn't connect with anybody. Because it worked before. You know, work again. So I did that. And she got sober, and I stopped drinking. And you know what happened? We found out we didn't like each other. And so now I was kind of like between a rock and a hard spot. So I did what any good drunk would do. I went and got another girlfriend. And I was doing my job, but I was also teaching at the academy. So I got one of these cute young students that wanted to be a cop, and that was my new girlfriend. And you know, she dumped me after a couple months, but it got me moved out of the house. By now, I'd gone through a couple houses, a couple good relationships, a crazy girlfriend. I started drinking again. Well, what happened was when I stopped drinking, I declared a sobriety date and was going to meetings, but that's all I was doing. And I went about 8 months, and it was Christmas time, Christmas, right before Christmas in 96, and my buddy didn't know I had really stopped drinking. And he gave me an engraved pewter flask with single malt scotch in it for a Christmas present, and I drank it. And I had avoided alcohol until somebody actually handed me something, and I drank it. So I drank that flask. It was 5 ounces, and I finished it in probably an hour. Because I was drinking like a gentleman. And I left his house, and I went to the liquor store, and I bought a fifth of whiskey. And I drank a fifth of whiskey every day for the next about 10 months. My drinking picked up like it had never stopped. In the book, they talk about the progression of the disease. It never stops. So if I was to pick up a drink tomorrow, it would be like it never stopped. So I started drinking again. I was off to the races. That lasted 10 months. And I was living alone in an apartment. I was working a shift that was 6 to 3. I was avoiding all the overtime I could get. My daughter came on weekends. And I entertained her while I was drunk. I would take her to the pool to swim, and I would sit and drink and watch her swim. I was there, but I was never there. Back in my marriage, I was there, but I was never there. When I was at work, I was there, but I was never there. And I didn't have any idea I was like that. During all this, I'd gone, I think by then I was on about my third counselor. And, you know, different titles, MFCC, LCSW, psychiatrist, psychologist, whatever. I'd gone through a bunch of them and did the touchy-feely stuff, and it didn't really hit home for me. So my drinking progressed, and one day I had enough, and I was with my buddy on a 2-day fishing trip. I drank all night. I was about 2/3 of the way through one of those things you guys call a handle now, I guess. Those 1.75 liter bottles of whiskey, just drinking it straight in a nice tea glass. And I was at San Luis Reservoir launching the boat. The sun was coming up, and I'd had enough. And I knew I was done. This is an emotional thing from the other deal that's bothering me. What happened was that pewter flask I still had because I used it. And I knew then I was done, and it was like I knew I was going to need an object to mark that moment. And I stand at the edge of the boat ramp, the edge of the water, and I looked down, picked up a piece of driftwood. And that was October 29, 1997, when I quit drinking. In my den, I have a display case with, you know, knickknacks, family pictures, stuff like that. And there's an abalone shell with chips in it. And pewter flask with my initials and nothing in it, and that piece of driftwood. So I see my last drink, when it started and when it ended. I have a reminder of it. So I went back to AA and went to meetings and didn't drink. Didn't get sponsored, didn't work steps. So I went like that for about a year and acted as if. And then it was like, maybe I should get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. It took me about 6 months. I worked steps 1, 2, and 3. He sent me off to do step 4. I kept going back. He kept explaining. I kept going back. And I could not do step 4. And it's been my experience watching other people that most people that get to that point will eventually drink again. I didn't. I went about 12 years. I didn't drink, I didn't do drugs, I didn't work steps. By about year 4, I quit taking chips and quit acting as if. By year 5, I quit going to meetings. And what happened during that period was this guy about year 4 came up to me and said, "I like what you have to say, would you sponsor me?" And I had enough respect for him to tell him one-on-one that I was a phony and I couldn't do it. It was a time that was a defining moment when my bullshit wouldn't work anymore. I ran out of bullshit mojo. So I quit going to AA. My wife's in the program. She has about 24 years. She got sober at 18 or 19, had 8 years sobriety, relapsed. Went out for 6 or 8 months, came back. She's been sober ever since. She put up with my crap during all that. And what happened was emotionally and mentally, I was a train wreck. I was a dry drunk. I was mean. I was angry. All that stuff that had been put in me as a child came back up. I was raised by a Volga German father that was a Marine in Korea that was in the poop, that didn't talk about it, that had PTSD and was physically and verbally abusive. And I wasn't good enough, and I wasn't tough enough, and that's how it was. So I rolled like that for a while till the insanity got the better of me. And I went back. I was embarrassed to go see my old sponsor. I went back, started poking around. I found a guy that was my current sponsor and asked him to sponsor me. And in those early days before I quit the program, he was in a meeting and he was talking. He's an old timer. He was sharing in a meeting, and it was a men's stag meeting, and he looked at the group and he said, "When was the last time you looked in the mirror and said, 'I love you'?" And man, I heard that. I had never done it. And I thought about it, thought about it, thought about it, and it took me months to work up the courage to sneak up to a mirror when nobody was home and do that. And it was one of the most uncomfortable moments I've ever had in my life. If you're new, or you've been here for a while and want to know how good your program is, or if you've been here a long time and think your program is good, between now and noon tomorrow, when you're all alone, find the biggest mirror in your house and try that and see how you feel. And God will tell you where you're at. So anyway, I went back, sought this guy out, Mike B. He's my current sponsor. His name's Mike Ruggetti. My name's Mike Bulger. There are a lot of Mikes in my fellowship and about 4 Mike B's. So I am Mike B number 2, which has been shortened to number 2. I got Mike. I started working the steps. I went through 1, 2, and 3. I'd done them before. Didn't seem too bad. What I learned in step 3, the second time that I didn't learn the first time, was that I had to actually let God drive the car. I believed in God. I had a higher power, but I wouldn't give him the keys to the car. And that's where my sticking point was. And I found that when I went to work step 4. I could not work step 4. I stuck on that thing. And every time I went to go do the writing, I couldn't do it. So because I had to be productive to justify not doing the writing, I went out and did yard work. Well, in about the 3 or 4 months it took me the courage to let God be in charge and do my 4 step, I pruned bushes and cleaned flower beds and mowed the lawn. Well, what happened was I ran out of foliage. I didn't have to prune a bush or do any yard work other than mow the lawn for about 2 years because I had pruned away so much stuff. So I got together with my sponsor. I worked the steps. We got to that 4th step. He sat down with me, explained it to me, the columns, the whole deal. And it was easy to start because you get to start it by writing a resentment list. So I got to write down everybody that pissed me off. I thought that was cool, which I wound up finding out was going to be my eighth step. So he showed me how to do a couple of these. Well, you get over the fourth column. And he showed me how to do it and asked me to do it. And I kind of stammered and stuttered. And he showed me. And we did another one. He stopped. He scratched his head. And he looked at me and he goes, you know what, Mike? He goes, we're going to do the fourth column together. I was so twisted and so delusional. And my thinking was so skewed that I couldn't do the fourth column. Even trying to, I could not do the fourth column. And then when I did the fifth with him, and I was sharing from my heart of hearts, me and him, it took about 14 hours to do that fifth step in two locations because we had to move. And he showed me where my thinking was incorrect when I thought I was being totally honest. So I got through the fifth step. I went home and did six and seven that night. And in the very next meeting I went to, and they read how it works like they did tonight. It had an entirely different meaning than the previous time I'd heard it, even all those years. I felt like I had earned my seat in the fellowship. That was the first time I felt like I legitimately belonged here. I continued through the steps, and one of the cool things when I went into the amends portion was that I had stolen some money. When I worked for Safeway, this family had lost their grocery money in the store, and I stole it. Instead of giving it back to them, I looked these family members in the face and told them I didn't know, nobody turned in their stuff, and I went and spent on drugs and alcohol. It was probably one of the lowest points of my life. You know, how low can you get? And I told my sponsor that. He told me a story that he did that was equally as bad to let me know I wasn't alone. But I learned about doing blind amends. I had no idea what that was. And it taught me how to be a service without expecting anything in return. And it's wound up being the foundation for what I do today. I finished up the steps. I did the amends. 10, 11, and 12 are hard for me because I got a big mouth and an acid tongue. And I fight with that on a daily basis. That's my biggest problem today is my mouth. Because I got no problem telling people where to get off. And the program teaches us patience, love, and tolerance. My wife is 4'12" and 110 pounds. And she grabs me and looks at me and tells me that I'm nothing but a big scared kid. And I need to let God be in charge. And I don't have to wear a gun when I go out of the house. Because I think the boogeyman's going to get me. And she's really heavy on the spiritual portion of this program. She's my anchor for that. My house is scattered with books by Emmett Fox, Science of Mind stuff, Ernest Holmes. I strongly urge you to read stuff that is not program material but relates to it. Like as a guy, you need to read Men Are From Mars and Women Are From that one. And because they think this way and we think that way and we have no idea about it. The Emmett Fox books are good. I like Herman Hesse's Siddhartha. I read a lot of Native American stuff. I got a buddy in these parts named Reyes. I don't see him here tonight. He's my Eskimo. So I embarked on this path of recovery. One of the things I did was during this, this gal came up to me in the fellowship and said, you should try my counselor. I went to this gal named Caroline Meyer. She's in Madera, California, and this is not an advertisement. But she's a Christian minister that grew up in a Wiccan household, has about 28 years sobriety, and will tell you where to get off. She sat down with me, went through my cultural background. Why do you want to know that? She explained to me why I do what I do, why I look at people the way I do, why I'm afraid of people, why, because everything to me is a matter of life and death. She pointed out things that I had no idea about. She helped me with that stuff. She's opened doors for me that no one else ever had. So my advice to you is keep finding that one, keep looking for that one person. Being in AA and working the steps caused me to go back to Narcotics Anonymous and redo that stuff. I had walked this path, not willing to do the work and turn over any of these stones. So I went back at the beginning and turned over all the stones that I wasn't willing to look under. And I discovered Narcotics Anonymous, Sex Anonymous. I qualify but don't go to any 12-step program there is. Oh, Readers Anonymous, if they got to ride your motorcycle too fast, I qualify that. AA is the foundation of my recovery. It's where I got sober. All the 12-step programs are based on it. So whatever you're dealing with, you can work it through here. If you need outside help, go get it. You want to read something that's spiritual related but not AA, go do it. It's not the destination, it's the journey. What I found out also with this counselor was I have PTSD complex. And I said, what do you mean complex? Is it my job? She goes, no. She goes, you were effed up all along. Your job at 25 years with the Sheriff's Department just made it worse. My dad raised me that way. My job made it worse. When I first went to meetings, I rolled my gun up in my coat and stuffed it in the corner because I didn't have any place to put it. I was on a motorcycle. I was that paranoid. You know, I don't have to look over my shoulder today. I can let God drive the car. I have a sponsor that has a sponsor, and my sponsor is an Emmett Fox nut. So we're all reading that stuff. I have sponsees. Rick and I had this conversation, one of my friends that I came up with from Sierra, which is my home group. We had the conversation about how many people do you sponsor, and I rattled them off, and he told me he heard one guy that was asked how many people do you sponsor, and he said about half of them. And I thought about it, and out of the people that I have, about half of them work the program and half of them don't. I've got newer people that I take through the steps. I'm starting to wind up with old timers that have lost their sponsors through attrition or movement, that we do like a maintenance program. I share that I deal with depression. I went to my doctor and told him I wanted to kill people. He told me I had depression, and I said no. I said I don't sleep all day. I'm real energetic. I'm real active. I do a lot of stuff. I just want to kill people. And he said, no, you have depression. And I learned about serotonin levels and all that stuff. They gave me an antidepressant. I took it for a while, maybe a year or two, decided I didn't need it. And it's kind of like in the big book where it says, try some controlled drinking. I went off of it without telling anybody and felt really good for about 2-3 weeks. And all of a sudden, stuff hit the fan. Went back on it, went about another year, tried it again, and stuff hit the fan. So right now I stay with that. I go to counseling at least twice a month. I'm active with my sponsor. I have an accountability partner. Now I have two because my sponsor's old. My accountability partners, we ride motorcycles together. They're my age. We're active. I see one or the other every day. They know I deal with depression. If certain people don't hear from me in a 24-hour period, they're looking for me. That's my program. Now, during that, I worked at the jail for a lot of my recovery, and even still when I was actually working a program. So I've had a program for 5 years, even though my sobriety date's old. What I wound up doing at the jail was being out about my program, and I got to 12-step a lot of people in jail. And I got to the point where, and I was on both sides of the bars. I was probably one of the few guys down there who spent quality time on both sides of the bars. And, man, I didn't have to go to high school reunions. I saw my old buddies there. I saw my relatives there. I understood where they were coming from. They used to say, man, you're cool. And I said, I don't understand where you're coming from. And then they'd say something else, and I'd say, well, you know, how's that working for you? You know? One of the worst ones I ever had was a kid that grew up next door to me, was out on parole as an adult, was under the influence and drunk, crashed his car and killed his infant son that was in the car when he was trying to run from the cops instead of just pulling over and taking a parole. And I sat and held his hand while he cried, trying to tell this guy it would be okay. When you kill your kid, it's never okay. But you got to do what you got to do. I said goodbye to people that I got to know pretty well that are now on death row or doing life in federal prison. Some of the best things I learned in recovery about treating people with respect and making amends and being a stand-up guy, I learned from convicts. In the program, I found, and I share with people, that the difference between cops and criminals is extremely minute. They're the same. The behavior is the same. They're type A thrill seekers. And if I offend anybody by that, that's just my experience. So doing the 12-step work and doing this and helping other people, what I've come to do is I've wound up being a secretary at meetings. I work with my fellowship. We do barbecues, events like that. I'm involved in that. I sponsor people. I'm currently a member at large, which means I have a key and I'm on call to cover a meeting. Our fellowship is big. We have 3 to 4 meetings, 7 days a week. I tend to migrate to 3 men's stag meetings, 1 at my fellowship and 2 at other fellowships. It keeps me out of one of my addictions, which is looking at women. I went to a mixed meeting yesterday and sat in the second row and spent the whole 45 minutes of the meeting looking at the 2 ladies in front of me. And once again, I was reminded of, like, where my mind will go unsupervised. I've learned to do a lot of stuff and not talk about it. One of my friends is an ex-con, and we were talking one day about recovering. He's got a few years, and he has little or no resources, struggles to get around, doesn't have a place to live, all that kind of stuff. So he was telling me he was in service, and I asked him what he did, and he said, "I went out and picked up papers in my neighborhood." He wouldn't have told anybody if I hadn't asked him. It can be as little as picking up papers. It can be as little as helping a stranger. I've gone on quite a few 12-step calls to some pretty sketchy places, to some nice places. I've worked in my fellowship. I continue. Our board stuff comes up in December. I'm going to put in for one of the board positions. I'm going to put in for treasurer. And to think of all the stuff I used to do, that they'll be able to trust me with their money. My biggest battle today is letting God drive the car and having to act tough because I'm scared. The sponsors that I have, or sponsees rather, that I have that I'm working with, when Bill asked me to speak in July, I was walking down the street with a guy named Jerry D that moved to Portland, and we were walking along minding our own business. I met Bill in July. I wound up here. As it got closer to the meeting, my committee gets busier, and it was like, I got to talk about being in service. I need something really good to share. Well, one of my sponsees got in a severe motorcycle wreck 3 weeks ago. He was unconscious for 2 weeks of it. He's awake now, but he doesn't know who we are. I'm watching 2 of his kids be drunk 2 days after the accident. One of his daughters totaled a car and got arrested. His son lost his job. We set up a fund, another one of those H&I things, and we have 2 funds. We have the Hand Me Some Cash So You Can Be Anonymous fund, and we have the fundraiser on the website for the people that need to show off. And so now I've got a daughter of his that is responsible, that I put in charge of the money, and she's got a brother and a sister that are playing the codependency guilt trip on her because they need money to party. I take people to meetings. I work with strangers. I'm open more than I was. God, there's so many things I do, and then all of a sudden you just get that blank moment. The group that I run with, there's a phrase that, and nothing's original to anybody, it's all been repeated, but it's, we're doing the deal. If somebody asks how somebody's doing, they just say, I'm doing the deal. And what that means is we're sober, they have a sponsor, they sponsor people, they're going to meetings, they're involved in some sort of H&I work. I don't do the H&I to the jail because I worked there for 25 years. I do like to show off that I have a key to the jail, and I do. The Fresno County has 3 jail buildings, and my key fits the front door and back door of all of them, and the executive bathroom. And I kept it as a souvenir. But everything I do, I've learned as I went along to be more and more under the radar about it. And what I found was there's a huge spiritual reward in doing things for other people when nobody knows. When I first started out, I wanted to make sure everybody knew. And it was like, hey, look at me, ain't I great? And I needed that because I have no self-esteem and I wanted to boost how I felt about myself. And I had spent my whole life putting other people down to make myself feel better, and now I couldn't do that. So I had to find other ways. So, you know, I would boost myself through the H&I. Well, what has happened between then and now is I wind up doing more stuff. I've gone to the prison, and to sit in a level 4 yard with a bunch of real convicts and have 3 other people on the panel with me from my home group that have all been to prison, and then me to say, I'm a jail guard at the local county jail. Those guys didn't bat an eye because I told my story. They knew what I was about. I told them the truth. The only person there that looked at me funny was the staff member. They couldn't believe it. But I go there to spread the word. I don't have to tell people anymore what you have to do. When I first got here, people told me, I heard them tell me, you got to do this and you got to do that. Those were what I heard when they made suggestions. And in hindsight, you know what? Damn it, they were right. I tried it my way. So if you guys are struggling with a program, I tried every other way to get around doing those 12 simple steps. And now I'm learning to live in those 12 traditions. And a couple of them are real important to me. You know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. So when I go to AA, I'm AA. There's also one there about anonymity and public stuff, press, radio, films. There's a huge thing going on now with Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. This motorcycle wreck, I've got people posting stuff about it that weren't there. The ride that these guys went on when they crashed, the people left them. When they saw that there was an ambulance there, the rest of the ride went on. And I'm supposed to forgive those people, and I can't. That's my battle right now. You know, I'm supposed to take the high road, be the good guy, and I'm struggling with that. This guy that I have in the hospital, I'm up to Modesto almost every other day. If I'm not up there, I'm over his house trying to do stuff, take care of his animals, help his kids. And it's not that I'm a good guy. It's what I do to stay sober. You know, it's not about me, but it's all about my sobriety. And, you know, I'm running out of time, and I'm getting emotional. I just hope in this that God told you something you needed to hear. If you have doubts about the program, it works. I had doubts. It works. Trust in the program. Let God drive the car and learn to do stuff for other people and not expect any recognition and try to avoid the recognition. God bless you. Thank you.